This is KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Tuesday, June 7th of 2022. I'm your host, Nicole Rubin. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's show, events in the Denver area this month will allow residents to voice their views about the reintroduction of gray wolves into the state's ecosystem. We'll visit an immersive multimedia exhibit on the CU Boulder campus that takes us inside of melting glaciers. And Congress appears pumped to fight climate change. We'll have that story and more on This Week in Water. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have an update from the BBC News headlines, and then it's How on Earth. On this week's science show, we hear about alternative methods for treating heart disease that stray far from current medical practice. At 9 a.m. comes Alan Watts, the British philosopher, writer, and speaker known for interpreting Eastern religious ideas for a Western audience. Then at 9:30, James Wise will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. All that's still ahead, but first, it's time for local and regional headlines with KGNU's Stacey Johnson.
A new law signed by Governor Jared Polis aims to strengthen protections for agricultural workers by making access to information about their rights under state and federal laws easier to obtain. The measure creates an online resource portal available in English and Spanish. It will include resources for mental health, workplace safety, links to relevant state and federal agencies, and a calculator that will assist business owners in determining worker pay based on their schedule. Lawmakers tasked the Department of Agriculture in developing the online portal, with the agency receiving $100,000 in funding to do so. This comes as Colorado lawmakers seek to ease tension from ag employers and workers over last year's legislation that aimed to improve working conditions for farm and ranch employees. Last year's legislation included overtime protections, minimum workplace housing standards, and collective bargaining rights. Since the passage of last year's legislation, farm worker advocates have sued the state over its overtime rules that they say gutted the intent of last year's legislation. Governor Jared Polis has signed a bill aimed to help workers collect legally earned wages. KGNU's Steve Miller has more.
The law is aimed to help victims of wage theft recover legally earned back wages. The law empowers the Colorado Department of Labor and Employment, CDLE, and the Attorney General to help workers collect back wages when CDLE find that the wages remain unpaid. The law allows CDLE to place liens on employer property, creates a worker protection unit in the Attorney General's office, and ensures that all workers are protected from retaliation for filing a wage theft claim. The group Towards Justice, a nonprofit law firm that represents workers, claims that employers keep $750 million in legally earned wages from Colorado workers each year. They add that most workers never get that money back, not even those who the CDLE has determined that the workers did earn that money. I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
Denver City Council approved three measures last night to expand housing affordability guidelines for new developments, regardless of if they are residential or non-residential. According to the Denver Gazette, around 50 individuals spoke at last night's public hearing. Under the guidelines, a certain number of affordable units must be developed alongside market-rate condos and apartments, or builders will need to pay a fee to offset construction of affordable units elsewhere. Zoning and financial incentives are also a part of the guidelines. The guidelines apply to new developments of 10 units or more, and if new construction is less than 10 units, builders will pay a one-time linkage fee to go towards the city's affordable housing fund. The future of a project to use a vacant Denver hotel to house homeless individuals is in limbo after Denver City Council member Debbie Ortega requested a postponement on a vote to extend the agreement. The city currently uses the downtown Aloft Hotel to provide food and shelter for those who are unhoused and at high risk of contracting the coronavirus. Denver began using the hotel at the start of the pandemic, and because of the recent uptick in COVID-19 cases, city officials want to continue using 140 rooms for another 6 months. According to the Denver Gazette, many individuals temporarily housed at the hotel are older residents with severe health issues or using wheelchairs, walkers, or oxygen tanks. Ortega's explanation for postponing the vote is that she was not present for the committee discussion on the resolution and that she has more questions, including how the city will transition clients from the program and how extending the agreement will affect the city's general fund. The hotel occupancy extension is estimated to cost the city around $13 million, or a room rate of $95 per day. The City of Arvada and Jefferson County filed a lawsuit last week against Broomfield over its withdrawal from the joint authority seeking to build a highway connecting Broomfield with State Highway 93 north of Golden. The planned 10-mile stretch of highway, called the Jefferson Parkway, will add to the roadways circling the Denver metro area, comprising of C-470, E-470, and the Northwest Parkway. The Denver Post reports Arvada and Jefferson County filed the lawsuit in Jefferson County District Court and are asking the court to order Broomfield to convey the land and right-of-ways within its jurisdiction to complete the parkway. The entities are claiming the parkway's completion is not possible without Broomfield's cooperation. The entities further assert that Broomfield's withdrawal threw the project into a disarray and leaves no way for Arvada and Jefferson County to recoup taxpayer money spent on the project. Broomfield withdrew its participation from the Parkway Authority in February 2020, citing an elevated reading of plutonium discovered within the proposed path of the highway, which is next to the Rocky Flats National Wildlife Refuge and former nuclear weapons manufacturing plant. The City of Boulder has opened the application period for grants targeted for local small businesses who continue to feel the impacts of the pandemic. According to the city's press release, Boulder is launching two business relief programs, one focused on small businesses and the other on childcare operations. The Small Business Grant Program will provide $400,000 in non-repayment awards, and the city's Child Care Grant Program will provide $100,000 in awards to state-licensed non-home-based child care establishments. The grant relief is part of the city's funding received under the Federal American Rescue Plan Act. The application period will end June 20th, and small business owners may find more information at the city's COVID-19 Business Resources webpage. Today's weather along the Upper Metro Front Range includes a 20 to 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms, mainly in the late afternoon hours. Patchy fog is expected to lift by mid-morning. Today's highs will be in the upper 70s, low 80s. Tonight, there is a continued chance of showers, mainly before midnight, and tonight's lows will be in the low 50s. The current temperature in Boulder is 55 degrees. For KGNU, I'm Stacy Johnson.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm Nicole Rubin. Hunting and other factors initially drove gray wolves from their homes in Colorado, but a 2023 program will reintroduce them to the Centennial State. This month, events in Denver area will allow residents to voice their views about wolves returning to the state's ecosystem. Chance Dorland has more.
After nearly a century, gray wolves are coming back to the state of Colorado. In 2020, voters approved Proposition 114, calling on Colorado Parks and Wildlife to restore native gray wolves to their historic habitat in the Centennial State. Dylan Hansen-Amata is the Southern Rockies field representative for the Endangered Species Coalition. He says the coalition is collaborating on multiple events and projects in Denver this June Wolf Month to celebrate.
This is a time for Coloradans to come get out and about and learn about wolves and the importance of having wolves back in the mountains of Colorado through these unique events that are focused on connecting art and culture with conservation.
Not everyone is a fan of reintroducing wolves. Ranchers worry they could lose livestock as a result. But after a February court order this year, gray wolves in the contiguous 48 states in Mexico, with the exception of the northern Rocky Mountain population, are now protected under the Endangered Species Act. Wolves are labeled as threatened in Minnesota and endangered in the remaining states, according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Hanson Amata says the desire for wolf pelts as fur and other factors robbed Colorado of its native wolf population.
Due to, you know, excessive hunting and trapping, the population declined, as well as habitat fragmentation and just basically human encroachment, wolves disappeared from the state.
Find a full listing of Wolf Month events, including even a brewery passport program, online at endangered.org/Denver Wolf Celebration. Hanson Amata thinks Coloradans should be proud of the reintroduction the state is planning for gray wolves in 2023.
The restoration of this iconic animal to the region is a remarkable conservation achievement, and Coloradans should be happy and take pride in this happening in their state.
Colorado Parks and Wildlife reports the plan being developed under Proposition 114 will be determined with partnering state and federal agencies to select which nearby wolf packs will be introduced to Colorado. For Colorado News Connection, I'm Chance Storland.
From activists and non-believers, climate change has been a hot topic for years now. Chris Dunn, a CU Environmental Studies grad student, spins a different perspective on the topic at his multimedia exhibit at the Jerry Crail Johnson Earth Sciences and Map Library. Kiara Damare reports.
You're listening to Glacial Melt from the Inside of Glaciers from both Greenland and Iceland. Captured by CU Environmental Studies PhD graduate student Chris Dunn, who created an immersive multimedia exhibit, Sensing Ice, Explorations of Knowing Nature.
I wanted to go to Greenland. Greenland and Antarctica also were huge on my list because I knew that there was just these massive bodies of ice, because I just got really interested in ice. All I knew was just from being in these icy places and seeing these glaciers over the years in Alaska in particular, but also Washington State and some other places. And I was like, these are really fascinating entities that just exist. They're just amazing. And I want to know more about this.
The exhibit is on campus in the Earth Sciences and Map Library. It features Dunn's photography and music by Alaskan composer Matthew Bertner that was performed and recorded on site with glaciers.
And so it's not really meant to be an educational exhibit. It's really meant to actually just be about the beauty of nature and some of the complexities of understanding nature and how we conceptualize it. So it's not about climate change awareness. It's about what nature is and what the human relationship with nature is. And so I did a lot of my PhD work on that question, like from like a philosophical, anthropological investigation. And this is like just kind of another way of exploring that same basic question, doing it in a way that is more immediately striking and more accessible. And to take a step back, part of the central component of that, of exploring that question of what nature is and how do we know it, is has to do with the senses. And how our direct sensory encounter with the world differs from something like how science works. And science often works by, particularly glacial science, often works by remote sensing and or interrogating things in a laboratory or ways that simply aren't as attuned to our sort of like base, our like baseline sensual immersion in the world. And which in philosophical parlance, this is called phenomenology, and just kind of actually explore that in a space through media and photography. That's really what I was going for. But then there is this aspect where you're seeing this glacial melt happening at what ended up being a peak, one of the highest peaks ever of surface melt on Greenland when I was actually there. And so when you're seeing these flooding going into the and with the recent rivers, there's massive flooding that's going into the ocean. I mean, you're really seeing this huge change. Like you're just seeing like one tiny itty bitty little component of this, one of the most massive changes that's probably ever going to occur in human history. And so I went in with one idea, but there's a lot of other things that are kind of spidering out from it. And that's the way it works, and that's the way it should work, I think.
While Dunn did a lot of work abroad, it wasn't until he came back did all of the work of putting on an actual immersive exhibit take place.
Putting the exhibit together was a whole nother level of difficulty. Like, I couldn't have done it without help. Like, I had the basic idea, and it was this extremely ambitious idea. Like, I wanted it to be overwhelming. I wanted it to be immersive, take you on a journey, and just, like, have a ton of photos. And I wanted one, like, really large, and I wanted some other media. And it was ambitious, basically. And so, like, actualizing that was not easy, but I had help, and I needed them. And so I want to just give them credit.
The exhibit is open Mondays through Thursdays from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. To keep up with Dunn's work, visit Chris Dunn on planetearth.weebly.com. For KGNU, I'm Chiara Damari.
It is now time for This Week in Water with Jamie Sudler and Franny Halpern.
Congress appears pumped to fight climate change. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halpern, and it's This Week in Water.
News broke last week that we passed a grim milestone. There's now more CO2 in the atmosphere than at any time in at least 4 million years. The amount of carbon reached nearly 421 parts per million because of power plants, transportation, farming practices, and a less talked about source, buildings.
Maintaining indoor spaces from furnaces and air conditioners to hot water heaters relies heavily on fossil fuels and produces roughly one-fifth of total global greenhouse gas emissions. While we can do things to make buildings more efficient with light bulbs or energy-saving appliances, one crucial way to decarbonize is to go all electric.
To that end, two bills have been introduced in Congress to transition to clean energy solutions and to promote heat pumps.
Despite the name, heat pumps can both cool a building in the summer and warm it in winter. They operate like a refrigerator, which pumps warm air out to keep food fresh. Only heat pumps go both ways and suck warm air in to heat a room.
One of the bills creates a rebate system for heating and cooling distributors to promote electric systems. The other provides tax credits for manufacturers to produce efficient heat pumps that consumers can afford.
Heat pumps would save consumers money on energy bills because they're up to four times more efficient than conventional equipment.
So, as the planet warms and demand for air conditioning rises, pumping up the adoption of heat pumps will reduce greenhouse gas emissions and be central to combating the climate crisis.
Scientists have discovered the largest living organism on Earth, and it's ancient, maybe 4,500 years old.
It's a seagrass plant off Western Australia that extends 110 miles, about the distance from Los Angeles to San Diego. What's remarkable is that it's one plant that has been cloning itself by creating new shoots off its root system.
The expanse of the seagrass is much larger than the Pando aspen grove in Utah, which consists of 40,000 trees all connected by their roots, and was, up until now, thought to be the biggest known living organism.
The seagrass can survive wide temperature ranges from 17 to 30 degrees Celsius and in seawater that has twice the normal salt content. The team found the plant exists in both darkness and extreme light, yet keeps on going.
But while the seagrass plant has been resilient, in the last decade it's shrunk by about 7 square miles because of cyclones and rising temperatures from climate change.
Home improvement stores have shelves full of chemicals that kill dandelions, which many consider to be unsightly blemishes on green lawns.
If they're not sprayed, many people eat dandelions in salads because they're healthy. They contain antioxidants, can reduce inflammation, and manage blood pressure.
The plants are not native to North America, and it's likely that they were brought over by European settlers because of their nutritional and medicinal content.
And they spread quickly because of how they disperse their seeds, which, according to new research led by Imperial College London, has a lot to do with humidity.
After the yellow flowers bloom, they develop into the familiar puffballs, most of which are the hairy bristles that link to the seeds. The bristles act like a parachute, and as the seeds break free of the plant, they catch the wind.
The parachutes can open and close. When it's drier, they stay open, taking the seed on a ride possibly for miles. But in wetter conditions, they shut and the seed drops.
Dandelion seeds are some of the best flyers in the natural world and can travel as far as 60 miles.
The scientists found that the center of the parachute senses the environment by absorbing water molecules from the air and responding.
But if you're wondering whether the research has any practical application, they say that the dandelion's response to humidity could help engineers create robots to move multiple fingers and arms with simple yet functional designs.
And finally, food waste is a huge problem worldwide. Not only do people go hungry, but discarded items took a lot of land, water, and energy to produce, only to have them rot in landfills and emit greenhouse gases that harm the climate.
But researchers in Japan have found a new use for food waste to construct a house out of it.
A team from Tokyo University has developed the world's first cement made using fruits and vegetables.
They say their product is nearly 4 times stronger than ordinary concrete and has the potential to create a sustainable substitute for cement production, which accounts for 8% of the world's carbon emissions.
The process, they say, is simple. Just dry the food, make it into a powder, then heat press it in a mold. And the kicker? It's edible, although a person would have to break it into pieces and boil it first.
Beyond cement, the researchers see the potential to transform food waste into household products. Last year, they launched a company to develop furniture, dishes, and utensils from the material.
They're weaving the food's colors, aromas, and textures into the designs, so now you'll be able to have your plate and eat it too.
That's it for This Week in Water. Support comes from GC Green, a veteran, woman, and Native American-owned clean energy and resiliency solutions company. Learn more at gcgreen.com.
We now check in with KGNU's comment line. There was only one caller this week, and we chose the most concise of the three messages he left.
Yes, hello. This is Kelvin the King Man, good, bad, and ugly guy. And, of course, I have a lot to say. I guess you would not surprised about that. But, nevertheless, I want to say, thinking of, commemorating, extremely grateful, honoring and remembering those who have thought about us and thought about us first. And I just want to say to our veterans and those who sacrificed so much physically and emotionally for us, I want to say thank you. That's all for now. I'll comment more on some other things later, but thank you on Memorial Day and Memorial Day and beyond. Thank you.
If you'd like to make a comment on something you heard on KGNU, you can leave a message at our listener comment line at 303-447-9911. We'll play the message back on Tuesday mornings at 8:25. Comments longer than 90 seconds may be edited for brevity in order to give everyone who leaves a message a chance to speak. And that's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. Thanks to Stacey Johnson, Steve Miller, Shannon Young, Kiara Damare, Jamie Sudler, and Franny Halpern for their contributions for today's program. I've been your host, Nicole Rubin. Stay tuned for How on Earth. That's coming up just after these news headlines from the BBC.